Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, and I am joined today by Megan Boxall. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, John.
Excellent. And Algie Hall. How are you, Algie?
Very good.
Very good. Smiling. Smiling in the face of adversity.
Gotta keep our spirits up.
It's been a very exciting week, hasn't it?
It has. Very exciting.
Yeah. Or has it? I can't work it out.
Oh, very exciting.
I mean, you know, read the headlines Monday, Tuesday, you thought the world was ending.
It's relative, isn't it? It's been so calm for so long. Something happens and everyone's, ooh.
It's madness. We're going to talk a bit about, well, I guess we're going to come on to that, but in a sort of roundabout way. What's been happening on the markets this week? Big sell-off, bit of recovery, bit of whipsaw market activity, volatility spiking. Wow. Volatility, you know, you don't expect to hear that on the 6 o'clock news, do you, really? There you go. And then we're going to talk to Simon Thompson about his column this week. I mean, the reason I've got Algie and Megan, both of you, here today is because I think we're going to drill down this week onto two pieces that you've written. Megan, the sector focus, which is about big tech, and most of that big tech is obviously American. And Algie, you've written on the same subject, coincidentally.
Yes,
Very serendipitous.
It is.
Serendipitous.
Great minds think alike and all that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, the great minds...
Or someone just copied my idea.
Yeah, we don't get precious about our you know, we're a team, Megan.
Yeah.
We're a team.
that was unnecessary.
Actually. Yes. Well, anyway, so basically, you've written about tech and the challenges it faces. And the reason that this is important in the context of the broad market is that these companies, as you've noted before, Algie, account for a very large... We're talking about Amazon, Facebook, Netflix. They account for a massive proportion of the US market.
Yeah, no, it's really short. It's almost a quarter of the S&P 500, I think.
I mean, it's insane. It's insane. So when they're doing well, the S&P 500 does well.
Yes.
When they're doing badly.
And also, given that what an important part of global indices the US is, you can say, you know, something similar for the actual world indices, which we look at as well, that they have a significant influence on that.
Indeed. And so I guess the reason why we're so interested in these companies, despite being a UK publication, is that they do exert a massive influence on the whole global investing landscape.
Absolutely.
And both of you have reasons to be worried about them, or have expressed some concerns in this week's magazine. Let's start with the sector focus, Megan.
Okay.
US tech,
yes.
Too big not to fail, or is it? Yeah. That's a little question mark there at the end.
Yeah, it is a question.
So talk us through the general theme running through the sector focus.
I was looking at all of the earnings, so all of the five FANG stocks, which is Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google, or Alphabet, had their...
We don't seem to be able to get that right, incidentally.
Yeah, because you can't call them FANG stocks with a G and not have Google in there, even though Google...
FANG.
You can put an M in there too, can't you?
Yeah, you can for Microsoft.
It's a horrible acronym.
Do they count?
Yeah, it's horrible. No.
No, they don't count.
No.
Come on, carry on, sorry.
They have had their results, or they had them last week, and yeah, it was just going through the results, which were generally very good. Most of the share prices did very well. This was before all the palaver at the start of this week. Most of the numbers looked great, but there are lots of things, and Algie has shared these feelings as well, that sort of are overhanging US tech at the moment. They have just got so big, and there's been so much evidence in the past of companies and industries which have got too big, have been regulated, have been split up. Amazon and arguably Google and Facebook are sort of ticking towards that.
Well, Microsoft, I mean, you mentioned them. They're obviously not one of what are classically now defined as the FANG stocks.
Yeah.
But Microsoft in the late 90s, 2000s,
yeah.
I can't remember what it was, but they were targeted
by
antitrust regulators, particularly in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the concern now.
Yeah, so that's what I mentioned, that Microsoft was regulated when it was doing incredibly well, when it looked untouchable, when the internet was rising and Microsoft was sort of pioneering the initial internet boom.
But Microsoft, I think Microsoft was more about that it basically controlled everybody's PCs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to get onto the internet, you had to have a PC.
Yeah.
If you had a PC, you had a Microsoft operating system.
Yeah, and that is exactly the same problem that's now facing Google and Facebook. I mean, we use Google as a verb. I was really struggling to define what to use to like to say to Google without saying to Google, because we use to Google. Yeah, but where are you searching? You're searching on Google. You're always...
Well, you might be using Ask Jeeves still.
Ask Jeeves was great.
I loved Ask Jeeves.
Yeah.
So the point is that these companies have become very large, exert a massive influence on society, almost, and certainly a number of industries, particularly the advertising industry, which you talk about specifically.
Yeah, so the advertising industry is really interesting because it's so much of advertising now is digital, because why wouldn't you advertise digitally when it can reach so many more people? And it can really target specific populations as well with digital advertising. And Facebook and Google account for so much of that, and it's become really tough for places where advertisers, well, people traditionally advertise, because of these two companies' dominance. But there is now the argument that because they've got so big, there's going to be some sort of regulation. And Facebook is already feeling a lot of pressure because it's not really, people don't like social media at the moment. Facebook has annoyed people. It's been accused of causing mental health problems in young adults. It's been accused of promoting fake news and terrorist ideas. And because it is doing that, people aren't necessarily going to be using Facebook as much. And then as a result, people aren't going to be advertising on Facebook as much. And that's where it gets all its revenue from.
But actually, I mean, you know, whatever criticisms you throw at these companies, that you talk about it in your piece, the network effect that they have means that actually everyone uses them.
Mm.
So the advertisers will keep using them.
Yeah.
But they control the market.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the worry of the regulator. Algie, you talk in your piece, in your further reading piece. This is what the innovation.
I should say it's not my piece because it's just pulling together some comments
which on it.
Fits together. But my photo goes on it, so that's great.
No, I mean, let's quickly rewind. Further reading. So basically, there's so much stuff out there.
Yes.
You had the inspired idea to start rounding this up, some of the views that were out in the market.
Yeah, it pulls together some of the stuff that we've been reading, which is publicly available. So people can read a bit about what we've been reading in these pieces and then go off and find the whole, you know, the whole piece themselves. And often, though, they're very long pieces, so maybe there's a service in summarising on a single page, available in the hundreds otherwise.
Indeed, thanks to social media, we only have an attention span of 180 characters. So well done, Algie. But this piece that you've looked at this week is, in fact, a speech by George Soros.
Well, that's how I lead in. Well, I mean, there's so many, like Megan has said, so many people have been talking about the evils, essentially, of social media and IT monopolies. You know, there's a lot of comment you could draw on, but that George Soros gave them a real broadside at Davos in his speech. So I'd start my further reading piece with one of his most pithy and venomous comments. Probably.
Not like George Soros to be pithy and venomous.
Said Davos is a good place to announce that their days, meaning the IT monopolies, as he calls them, are numbered. Regulation and taxation will be their undoing. So he's basically set out the case of how they're anti-competitive and how they could really destroy the fabric of society, essentially.
Yeah, I've got to admit, I'm no fan of social media. I think it's actually, this is being debated in Parliament this week, you know, on online trolling and attacks on politicians, and in fact attacks on anyone in the public limelight. Katie Price, I think she makes a good point, which is something I have never ever said before about Katie Price. Mm. But she makes a very good point that it's disgusting, some of the behaviour that takes place on these.
People just hide behind the screen, hide behind their online persona, and it's as if the people who they are trolling aren't real, and it's just awful. And that's unfortunately what has been aided by these social media networks, which allow these online trolls, and the fact that they are now receiving criticism for it isn't good for their future, which is why Facebook this week has decided that it's going to overhaul its news feed to make sure that we're not having any of this nonsense anymore in the news feed. But then people are worried.
Which means nonsense? Fake news?
Fake news.
Yeah, but who defines what's fake news?
But also people, the ability...
I just don't get that. Who defines what's fake news? Because so much news today is just opinion.
I've forgotten why I heard this point of view, but I heard someone describing essentially the client of these social media groups or the Facebook type, you know, news creators as being the advertisers. So the news they're presenting and they're kind of pushing are things which people will naturally, you know, gravitate towards and read, which are the, you know, the shock headlines.
Clickbait.
Yeah, and also I'm pretty sure it was in this context, I think it was a podcast I was listening to, using that old phrase, if it bleeds, it leads. So it's kind of these events which are very shocking, but really don't tell you anything about, you know, the big picture. They're kind of one-off shock events which would just get people clicking. And easiest way to create a shock event is just to make something up. And then someone clicks on it, you get the advertising revenue. You know, that's the way that market works. But actually, for the person who uses it, it doesn't actually give them what they want or should want, I suppose.
I have to say, I think this week's smallish sell-off fits that definition quite interestingly, you know, quite accurately. Because
yeah, the more
it
hysterical
wasn't a massive
you can be,
market
the
event. You know, there were a couple of VIX based volatility ETFs that went tits up. But the reality was it was a very smallish correction. There's been a bit of a recovery, but the headlines did not
for most of us.
That.
I mean, I suppose there are interesting aspects to it, which is there are lots of reasons for thinking there could be something far more serious.
We'll come on to
actually
that.
Actually, may happen, and also. Inside that, what did happen with those short VIX funds from the outside didn't seem like, you know, very much going on at all. The fact that these massive funds collapsed, you kind of think, well, you know, do these financial products, which everyone's been talking about as being dangerous, are they really a danger? Because, you know, they obviously are very fragile.
Well, Carl Icahn, and I mentioned this in my editorial, we are straying away from the topic of tech, but we will come back to it. Carl Icahn, as I mentioned in my editorial, he's saying basically these derivative products are dangerous and they could actually precipitate a market crash. We've seen fault lines this week.
Rumbles of something that might be ahead.
Carl Icahn used it.
Yes.
I think he's got a point, but you know, what going back to the tech stuff, hyperbole dominated this week. Mm-hmm. Fake news or hyperbole, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
But who defines it? I mean, George Soros' specific point is about the monopoly advertising power of some of the big platforms.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's the point I pulled out. His speech was far more wide-ranging, but yes. But I think that's a salient thing for investors.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and for sure, because that is where Google and Facebook that's the only place they make their money from. And yeah, if it's them being regulated and that is certainly something that is looming, but also the fact that Amazon and Netflix are now considering putting ads around their TV content, and that would be huge because everyone uses, well, not everyone, but a lot of people are using Amazon Netflix now to watch TV. That's competition, which would actually be good for Google and Facebook in terms of the regulation. If they do start facing some competition, regulators might take a step back and say, actually, they don't have a monopoly anymore. But in terms of where the growth is coming from, it does look like there are going to be difficulties for these advertising platforms.
I think that's true. I mean, we talked about this yesterday. You know, regulating a market and advertising is a market. Yeah, I can see how regulators around the world, antitrust law could look at that and actually do something to change the dominance these companies have in those markets. Regulating content, regulating user-driven content, I don't see how they can do that.
No, it would be tough, but I mean...
What they promote, I imagine. But I mean, yeah, who knows?
Yeah,
I have no idea. It's a brave new world.
I guess the point that we, you know, going back to the market, the broader market, is that if these companies come under attack from regulators, then it has a potentially massive effects on the whole of the global market.
Well, absolutely, yeah. The margins probably inevitably fall if they you know do the right thing. I say it, you know, in inverted commas, or if they're made to do the right thing, even worse. And then also, a regulated company. How do you price that? You don't price it like you price Facebook or Google at the moment. Mm. You know, it's a far more pedestrian type of being in terms of the investment returns one would expect.
Mm. Yeah, yeah,
so, yeah.
And Amazon is another one, not in the advertising space, but Amazon's definitely getting evil glares for its being so big and being so dominant and hurting the consumer market. And the fact that now you can't buy cheap books on Amazon anymore because Amazon doesn't need to make its books cheap. It's the only place that sells it.
I was thinking about this. I mean, I've often thought about Amazon and thought, oh, God, you swine. And then obviously my...
Did you use that word?
To all... What, in my own head? Yeah, I used it. But proceeded to use them to buy pretty much everything I ever buy.
Because there isn't anywhere else.
Yeah, and you know, my view of Amazon, they might object to this, but I remember when they were smallish, you know, and started selling books and then music. You know, they were the cheapest.
Yeah.
And companies like HMV or Waterstones basically faced just this onslaught of price competition to the point where they couldn't survive anymore. And they disappeared. Mm-hmm. So now you can't walk down, you know, you can't walk home, casually pick up a CD on the way home from work. You have to go to Amazon, who will deliver it the next day. Great. But they're not cheap anymore.
No, exactly. Because they don't need to be. Because they've got no competition. And they've done that in books and music. And now they've started going into food. And yeah, it's only early stage. But I mean, if it does the same thing as it did with books and music, then all our food's going to get more expensive in the future. Healthcare as well.
Healthcare, I think, is interesting.
Healthcare is interesting.
So, I mean, is this a kind of PR move?
Well, this is what I point out when in my article this week. I mean, the timing is very, very odd. Like, it looks like they're trying to butter up the politicians at a time when they might need a little bit of backing from people who arguably could regulate them, could force them to split up. So by taking on healthcare, which is arguably the most hated industry in America, especially at the moment, Amazon
it's the most
is
loved industry in Britain, incidentally, except by Donald Trump.
Yeah, who thinks?
I mean, interesting though, the whole Amazon thing, it touches on there's a, which is also mentioned in the further reading piece. There's a whole wider debate. Especially in the US, about the concentration of power, this idea that returns are higher for companies now and more consistent because there's too much monopoly power, and it's coming. These high corporate profits are coming at the expense of the man on the street, and investment in business. So I mean, that it's not only the antitrust stuff isn't only to do with big tech. It's kind of, there's a wider debate as well, which is, you know, very interesting.
Well, we're doing a big property piece next week. Jonas Crossan has written it, and you know, for example, UK retail property. I mean, it's in real trouble, and you know that has to be directly linked to the Amazon effect. Mm. Has to be.
Even though Amazon say they only have a very small amount of the UK market share, Amazon don't. They don't split out. They have US and rest of the world in their results. And they say they've only got a really small proportion of the UK retail share. But I don't know if that's true because everyone uses Amazon. And,
yeah, and in my house, when I was doing my tax return, which I do for my bank statements, or Amazon.
Yeah. We get an Amazon delivery every couple of days. Just because you can. Just because it's free and it arrives within a day.
Okay, so I guess the million-dollar question, billion, trillion, whatever, is, you know, I mean, do we like these companies? Are we so, I mean, we have in the past been very supportive of these shares. I mean, they are great growth stories as the market currently stands, as the regulatory environment currently stands. Are we sticking to that?
I mean, I think there's reason to be wary. They have grown just so fast, so well, and now they are incredibly impressive companies, but... Yeah, they are also very expensive, and if the markets are starting to turn, then I don't know if you want to be in big tech. The one that we do like is Apple. I still really think Apple is a good company, and it has got a bit more competition than the other four. It's not going to be as heavily hit if there are changes in the antitrust laws. And yeah, its results weren't fantastic. Its new iPhone, I mean, it seems like it's just too expensive and not as many people want to buy it. But it's got so much cash. I mean, it could buy every single UK company apart from Shell just with its cash. It can spend that cash.
I've never heard that
before. It's crazy, isn't it?
That is crazy.
Yeah. And if it isn't going to acquire something, then investors are going to get a nice dividend.
You know, it sort of reminds me of like those sort of dystopian science fiction films that you see, like, you know, Blade Runner, the Tyrell Corporation, which basically controls the world. I mean, this is what people are actually genuinely now worrying about.
And controls all our data as well.
Yeah, Amazon's got all our data in the cloud. And that's the bit that I suppose if someone was going to come down hard on Amazon, that's the bit that they could make them split off. That's the bit that's profitable. And Amazon would struggle to expand as fast as it has done without the profits that come from its cloud computing business.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Mm. But making companies spin stuff off is not as easy as we would like it to be. BT, which you've written about this week as well, haven't you?
Yeah, BT. It should be easy to make BT spin off Openreach. It's crazy that it hasn't, but I think the reason for that is the massive pension scheme and all the millions of people in the UK that rely on it. And if it doesn't have Openreach, BT's just going to really struggle, and then there's going to be lots of people without their pensions.
Maybe in Britain we're just rubbish at monopolies. should we talk to Simon? Hello, Simon. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's beautiful here on the Kent coast. Absolutely sunny. Very, very cold, but a beautiful day.
Oh, lucky you.
I know. just rubbing it in, John.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks, Simon. So, you know, it's good to have you on the phone. It's good to get the comedy double act back together.
well, some people liked it last week, seemingly.
Apparently so. My favourite comment of all time on the website. I tell you what, let's start with, while Algie and Megan are here, the market. What do you make of it all?
I think it's good that the froth that's within the market has been taken off, that the emerging market indices were up 11-12% in January at one point, that's year to date. The S&P 500 was up the best part, 7.5%. It had its best January since 1987, I think, up over 5%. Obviously, rates of increase of that magnitude in such a short space of time is not sustainable. So it's actually good for some of the froth to actually come off and people to revisit the fundamentals behind investing and look at where the market is in terms of earnings expectations and earnings growth. But basically, it's a Wall Street thing that and always is, that, you know, when Wall Street sneezes, the rest of us catch a cold, and that's what you've seen here. Ultimately, I think when the dust settles and people reassess where they think interest rates in the US are going and expectations of the bond yield curve, that, you know, this might just be a blip in the overall bull market.
You think this could be, this little pullback could be actually a buying opportunity then?
It certainly is for some of the companies I'm following, that basically everything got dragged down altogether, and unjustifiably so for many companies. Of course, you know, if the US is going to increase interest rates more times this year than people expected, then you've got to take that into account. But equally, with the steepening of the yield curve, you know, 10-year bond yields are close to 3%, you've already had a tightening of monetary policy, because in the US, that filters straight through to fixed-rate mortgages, given that swap rates are actually priced off US treasuries. So maybe, you know, the expectations of one extra rate increase won't actually happen, because you've already had this monetary tightening.
Okay. I mean, are you not worried? I know that, I mean, both Algie and Megan have written features in the last few months talking about, you know, worries around the kind of fragility of the market, you know, some excessive valuations perhaps creeping in. I mean, are you not worried beyond the interest rate cycle? Are you not worried about the ratings being put on some of these companies?
I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, especially when you look at the technology sector. You know, for example, I put the readers into Manchester and London Investment Trust last 12 months ago for the bargain shares. And, you know, that trust is up the best part of 65-66%. And that is down to its technology bias. Half of the trust is actually in the FANG stocks in the US. And then when you look at the underlying case for each one of those, then it's quite hard to justify some of the valuations there. But it's not across the board, is what I'd say. The segments that I look at the markets that I still see value opportunities in, and that's a reason to stay invested.
It's definitely staying invested, but is it a time to buy?
It's a time to bargain hunt.
Aha.
and which is what I think I've been doing in this week's column. So, yeah, selective buying. That, you know, last year I took money off the table in certain companies that the share prices had doubled, trebled, quadrupled, and I advised users to sell 2/3 of the holding and run the rest for free. And in many cases, that was the right thing to do. So, I mean, I remember actually taking money off the table in Cineworld, not a company I'd normally actually invest in because it's outside my small cap remit. But a few years ago, I spotted the CEO and other directors actually buying, and the shares doubled. And, you know, back in May, I thought, yeah, the rating is high enough. It might go a bit higher, but take money off the table. And, you know, several companies I follow, I recommended that. So people should have cash on the sidelines to basically take advantage of, you know, these short-term buying opportunities. I mean, the thing is that pullbacks, corrections are just the norm in bull markets. The fact that the S&P 500 went 400-plus trading days without a 5% pullback is pretty unprecedented. And that then led people to start taking positions on volatility, in effect selling volatility because they didn't think we'd ever have a spike. And one of the reasons why you have such dramatic moves in the markets in the last week is because people that basically short of volatility got absolutely smashed, and then you had algorithmic trades going through the markets, punishing them even further. You know, the VIX index went from roughly around 10 to 50 at one point. So anyone that's actually short of the VIX was absolutely hammered.
This was the point that the Carl Icahn was making that I mentioned earlier, that he basically doesn't like these derivative products, and he thinks lots of people are in instruments which potentially have sort of the possibility of contagion. I guess his worry, and mine too, is that combined with this whole value, you know, these big important companies being very expensive, you have this kind of interlinkedness in the market, which potentially has the potential to create these catastrophic domino effects.
Oh, it does. And the other thing is that obviously as valuations get more extended, then any spike in volatility from low levels will have a more dramatic effect than, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, which is why you saw, you know, the largest drop in Wall Street in points terms for the Dow Jones this week in one day.
Although it was quite small in the grand scheme of crashes, as Algie has explored before in The Anatomy of a Crash that you wrote.
the other thing, John, is that you've got to put this into perspective. I'm looking at the screen at the moment, and the S&P 500 started the year at 2,672. According, it's just opened now, and from Thursday, and it's above that level. So, yes, we've had a correction, but the US market is still up.
Yeah, well, indeed. And you know, as I wrote last week, my Kop Hocking indicators were still staying by, so, you know, for a lot of these markets, even though they look quite expensive. As I explained last week, I think the momentum is starting to wane, however. I think the power of the upward moves in those indices is definitely fading. Definitely.
Oh, no, I agree with you there. I mean, you can't expect markets to rise, you know, 3, 4, 5% a month continuously. I mean, that's just stupid. And when they do, then it just increases the risk that you'll have these pullbacks, which we've seen this week. But also, you've got to take into account also that the outlook for the global economy is actually pretty positive. And, you know, we've been wanting inflation for some time, and now we've actually got it. So we're normalizing interest rate policies. So the world is actually coming back to where it should have been, you know, well, 10, 11, 12 years ago. So that's actually positive in the scheme of things. No, I still think it's, you know, it's a buying opportunity for selective companies.
Well, we're all quite gloomy in the office, and you're obviously down on the Kent coast feeling much more optimistic. Maybe it's the weather. Maybe it's the environment.
maybe it's a different perspective completely, and stepping back and not getting involved completely in, you know, what's going across the computer screen every minute, and taking, you know, a more, I'm not going to say rational approach, but, you know, a more sensible approach to what's actually happened.
Well, you're kind of filtering out the noise, which is what we were talking about earlier with, you know, fake news, or you know, the hyperbole of the kind of the kind of market commentary that's been happening over the last few days?
Well, I mean, the thing is that I think it was on Wednesday last week after we went to press, Bank of America, who've got this bull bear indicator, came out with a sale warning on the market, and you know, within a few days that happened last Friday with the wage figures in the US. But equally, other big banks and Wall Street have, you know, done the same. But they're not calling for a bear market. They were just calling for a normal correction. And whether or not you stay invested in the market now is dependent on whether or not you believe what we've seen this week is actually the start of the bear market, or whether it's just a normal bull market correction. And for the time being, I'm going with the latter.
Okay. So I think we have time for one update from your column this week. What are you going to pick?
I had a really interesting conversation with the chief executive of WH Ireland, a small cap broking house and private client wealth manager. They've been restructuring and taking costs out of the business and transferring their platform to a third party that basically administers over £2.9 billion of assets under management. And as a result of that, their operating profits before exceptionals in the last year is roughly £400,000 and £28 million worth of revenue. What wasn't disclosed in the release, which I got from Richard Kellingbeck, the chief executive, is that in the current financial year, they expect to make annual cost savings of £2 million. Roughly £500,000 of that is margin improvements by transferring about £150 million of advisory assets under management across to high-margin discretionary ones. There's another £500,000 through the absence of non-recurring charges. Same again from absence of double-counting overheads, which they saw last year. And balance basically reflects personnel and cost savings and compliance. I mean, the bottom line is here is that the company has taken out the costs. Mr. Killingbeck says WH Ireland is still too small. It's got two very supportive shareholders behind it who control roughly 45% of the equity, who've just supported a small fundraise. So it's got 30 million cash in the bank, no debt, market cap £36 million. It's got a corporate broking business that on its own segmental profits about £1 million a year. I can see two scenarios unfolding here. Either the company's going to make a series of bolt-on acquisitions and a strong return to profitability on the private client side, and that's going to drive the share price re-rating, or it's going to become a big target. I can't see the share price being 135, which is roughly where it is at the moment, 36 million market cap, in 12 months' time. Something's going to happen here. I've got a target price of 175, which is below what brokers have in the stock. I don't think that's unrealistic on a sum of the parts basis. And also the cash backing on the balance sheet. You know, the corporate broking arm's got to be worth something alone. The valuation here is very, very, very attractive.
Okay. Interesting. And obviously you've written about, I think, three other companies in this week's column. I would encourage readers to get the magazine and have a read of those. But thank you, Simon. I'll leave you to enjoy the Kent coast and the sunshine.
Absolutely. And you have a good weekend as well.
You too. Speak soon. Okay. Well, let's just round up what else we've got in the mag. Sorry, I didn't bring you into that discussion about the...
That's okay.
About the markets as much as I would
Simon
have liked to.
Simon covered it very well.
He did cover it. Well, that's Simon for you, isn't it? As I say, he is...
I'd love to know whether he's got the numbers on a screen or if they're just in his head.
They're in his head. They're in his head. He's Simon is a genius. And you know, Megan, I don't dish out praise very much.
No, I was going to say, whoa, John, what's going on?
Let's quickly turn to the results section. I know you've written a couple of interesting ones this week with your other hat on, your farmer hat.
Yeah.
Pharmaceutical hat.
Yes.
Glaxo and Astra have both reported this week.
Yeah, they were interesting.
Interesting, if only because neither of them were able to get analysts to update their forecast, which is really strange.
There are a few now, but I mean, Big Pharma it's a funny one. The analysts don't seem to be really quick to update their numbers. But then, should you be looking at analyst forecasts when you're assessing the value in a pharma company?
I'd say no.
Pipeline. You look at the pipeline. You look at which has got a better pipeline, and of those two, it's definitely AstraZeneca.
Okay, And what's that? What are our views on those companies?
Astra, we say buy Astra and sell GSK.
Wow, sell GSK.
Yeah, because it's only a matter of time before they're going to cut their dividend because they just can't afford it. And they've said they're going to keep it at 80p this year, but that's only, the quote was something to do with as long as there isn't anything else that comes along. It wasn't exactly those words. But and the other thing that might come along is Pfizer's consumer health business, which they've said they've made an offer for. And that's going to cost about $15 billion. And if that is what they want to do, then they're not going to be able to afford the dividend. And that is kind of priced in. The share price has been completely hammered this year. But I think there'll be a bigger fall if they do cut the dividend.
Oh dear. Well, they certainly didn't pop up in your reliable income screen this year, Glaxo, or Astra for that matter.
No, they weren't there.
So, Algie, I mean, we don't often get a chance to talk about the stock screens, but this is a good one. People like reliable income.
Yeah, this is a good one. But the thing is, I originally called it the inflation beaters. Stock screen, and obviously now
there was none,
and well, there hasn't. Yeah, there wasn't any for 6 years, and now suddenly though it is kind of more topical because I mean they, with you know talking about the what's happened this week with the markets, really there is, Simon mentioned, the trigger with that was those wage numbers and people being paranoid that inflation is going to be far more significant than anyone's been giving it credit for. But the actual screen itself does quite a good job of picking what are known as bond proxies, who would be a lot of people think they would really be hurt by inflation.
We got what you would call a bond proxy in the tip section this week, which has suffered. Yeah. People have been worried about the prospects of these bond proxies, and we think those worries are overplayed essentially.
Simon has, alluded to the reasons why you don't necessarily need to panic about what's happened. And, one of which is that interest rates really still are really very low. But the fear is they'll go a lot higher than people expect. And then people will be, reassessing how they value. This screen comes back with some of them are, but, classic bond proxies, I'd say, like, Diageo is one that stands out. But then others are more domestically focused. So people are, a lot less keen on them, like Whitbread, which by historic standards looks very good value at the moment.
I was going to say, is this a Brexit thing? Are they cheap? Because people are worried about the impact of leaving the EU on the UK economy.
It's slightly that kind of Brexit consumery thing. And then it's also just, the hotel cycle. It's people get their confidence back, hoteliers get their confidence back and start building hotels, opening new rooms, which means can't push up room prices so much anymore, even though occupancy is good. And then ultimately occupancy falls away and you've got loads of supply and it all goes horrible. But at the moment, we're not at the final stage, but we are quite far into the hotel cycle, so it's harder to push up the prices of rooms. So
that's Whitbread.
Yeah.
What's their chain? I can never remember which one it is.
Premier Inns.
Premier Inns. Yeah.
And they're expanding to Germany, though. That's where they're trying to eke out better growth. Apparently underserved budget hotel market.
Oh, there you go. Who'd have thought it? I must admit, looking down that list of, how many you got there? Eight? Seven? Seven shares. The UK's most boring company sits there at the bottom.
Bunzl. Yeah, absolutely.
Bunzl.
But boring Bunzl has had a very good run, really. Isn't that right?
It is. It's had an incredible run. Absolutely incredible.
That's benefited from the whole bond proxy.
Yeah, I remember the days when they used to describe Capita as boring.
Oh, yeah. Or defensive growth.
Yeah.
neither is true anymore, it seems.
Certainly not boring. Bunzl is boring. Sorry, Bunzl.
Boring is good.
Boring is good. We like boring. Mm. Let's call it a day. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Megan. Thank you, Algie. Quickly talk you through what else we've got in the magazine. Getting a bit busy on the results front.
It's going to get
busier still in the weeks ahead. A bit quieter this week.
Week's quiet and then it starts.
Then it starts to pick up in late Feb.
There's three on Tuesday and that's pretty much it next week, or Thursday. And then it starts.
It's exciting. Exciting, but not as exciting as the markets this week, which were really exciting before they stopped being really exciting. So what it's got, lots of comments, including Algie's new initiative there, which I hope other writers will start contributing to as well. Might do one myself at some point. Yeah, absolutely. Mine will be really boring. It will be about industrial policy. This is my pet love. Lots of the personal finance and funds section there. exploring the infrastructure theme again, particularly looking at PFI in the wake of the Carillion collapse, which is a really interesting subject. Lots of companies with exposure there that retail investors might have some exposure to. And yeah, it's a really interesting news story this week. James Norrington has looked at the volatility aspect of this week's sell-off. And in fact, we did a podcast this week, didn't we, Megan?
Mm-hmm. On US bond yields. James talked about that with Chris Dillo and Alex Newman.
And that actually preceded the sell-off, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It was actually very weird timing, because I think it was, we published it on Monday as the markets were starting to fall. So
yeah. Well done, Megan, new podcast editor.
I had nothing to do with that, but thanks anyway.
No. You always take credit where it isn't due. Never turn down a
especially from you.
Honestly, what are you like? And actually, a really interesting story on the US shale industry, and actually, for me, this is really interesting. The Stagecoach story and its essentially being taken off the East Coast mainline.
Yeah, I mean, do all these big contracts, complex contracts, encourage the over-optimist to be the winner, who then has to deliver on.
You wrote that last week?
I have written that, yeah.
I used that as the quote last week. Yeah. Bloody optimists. Who needs them? Anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you, Algie. Thank you, Megan. And thank you, Simon, over in Kent. And we'll be back again next week. Sage Advice, actually, when he talks about the cover feature, which is written by Philip Ryland, rounding up some lessons from Warren Buffett's earliest letters. And actually, it's really good. I mean, these things get trotted out ad nauseum, but it's really good to revisit the early ones when he was getting that incredible investment firm established, especially in the context of this week's market sell-off.
I did highlight a quote.
Maybe,
From Philip's piece, on forecasting by Buffett. My own investment philosophy has developed around the theory that prophecy reveals far more about the frailties of the prophet than it reveals about the future.
That's what you chose.
In terms of all the predictions which are being made around a minor correction in the markets.
Very true, very true. Yeah, which is why, you know, it's difficult. You're in the markets, you're expected to prophesize, annihilate. Anyway, thank you for listening. And on that note, pick up the magazine, all good news agents, Sage Advice, lessons from the letters of Warren Buffett, or get online and subscribe. Speak soon.